KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. As a leader of New York University's Islamic Center back in 2001, then-college student Harun Mogul was thrust into the spotlight after September 11th happened, becoming a reluctant spokesperson for New York's Muslim community.
Professional Muslim is kind of like being a firefighter. Every time something bad happens, you're called upon to apologize, to explain. It means that your entire identity is pegged to events in other parts of the world, usually and almost exclusively negative events.
Join our conversation with Harun Mogul. It's up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In 2001, Harun Mogul was a student at NYU and a founder of the university's Islamic Center. But after a crisis of faith, he had plans to leave his leadership role, and instead, the 9/11 attacks thrust him into the spotlight as a spokesperson for American Muslims. Now, Mogul is out with a memoir titled How to Be a Muslim, An American Story, and he joins us this hour in studio to talk about his struggles with bipolar disorder and the burden of being a professional Muslim. Welcome, Harun Mogul.
Thank you for having me.
You were called upon to be, and I suppose this is the way you have termed it, a professional Muslim. It was not necessarily a calling that you felt you were seeking at the time.
It was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. I was the kid in New York that when the subway train approached and there were too many people on the car, I wouldn't get on because I was afraid of large numbers of people. And then I ended up in a position, like you said, where it seemed like everyone in the world wanted someone to explain everything about Islam. And being a 21-year-old kid, probably not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Not only the explain, though, but in many cases it was like people wanted you somehow to apologize or really say how sorry you were or something along those lines for the really actions of people who are other part of the world.
Yeah, and I think that still happens to a significant degree. My second book reading, I was asked my opinion on Hamas and other terrorist organizations, which I found a little bit jarring because the book, as you said, has actually nothing to do with politics or national security. But for some folks, if they see Muslim, they assume that we must all be the same. And so
there's a hybridized identity in all this, and it's hard sometimes to really reconcile or synthesize. I mean, for many ethnic American people or people of different backgrounds can identify with this. But the Muslim identity becomes particularly in some ways onerous, really. I mean, because suddenly the president retweets things from England First that are Islamophobic by any standards, and you have to answer for them because you're Muslim?
Philip Klinkner found that the single question most predictive of whether someone voted for Clinton or Trump is whether they thought Obama was a Muslim. And so it's a peculiar moment to find yourself in when you're 1% of the country and you feel like the entire fate of Western civilization hinges on what people think of your identity. And it is an onerous moment, and it's at times a very depressing moment.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, and how it affects your psyche. I mean, we'll talk about the memoir, but really right up to the present time that we're experiencing now. I mean, not only those retweets, but the immigration ban and so forth. I mean, these things have been piling up, and we're in kind of an alt-right world of this sort of what I think can easily be understood as Islamophobia.
For me, the moment that was the most jarring was during the campaign when now President Trump, then candidate Trump, proposed a total ban on Muslim immigration into the United States. And it was pretty far-fetched at the time. But the fact that he was saying it and that he wasn't apologizing for it and he seemed to be getting traction for it was deeply disturbing. And I think that was the first moment where I felt existentially rattled as an American. Now, obviously, like you said, Islamophobia is a real thing, and people do experience discrimination religiously, racially. You know, those are obviously undeniable facts. But for me personally, I had never felt any significant degree of pushback based on my identity that I thought would affect me personally until that moment. And that has become the new normal.
Well, there's even what may be considered the new abnormal. There was an article by Daniel Altman. I don't know if you happen to see it in Foreign Affairs. It just came out recently that said that some of the rhetoric we're hearing from the Trump administration, and I don't want to, you know, be giving clarion calls here for excess or for hysteria, but He was comparing it to other genocides that, you know, you try to dehumanize and dehumanize, and then you get to the point where, I mean, good example, Rwanda, for example, you know, the Hutus and the Tutsis kept dehumanizing them to the point where they were expendable.
I live in New York City. You're here in the Bay. I'm sure there's times when you walk around and you think to yourself, is this actually happening? And that doesn't mean I necessarily think we're going in that direction, but just in terms of the political conversation we're having. And one of the reasons why I wrote this book and deliberately did my best to avoid a full frontal discussion of politics is because we don't let Muslims be fully human beings with complicated lives and stories and motivations and interests. And to me, it was very important to stake a claim in this moment for being a fully human individual and not just a caricature.
Well, you certainly did that in this book. I mean, you write about depression, you write about bipolar, you write about, you know, so many things that probably are universal for so many people or that they experience even indirectly through loved ones and the like. So this is maybe giving a service to the idea that there's a lot of humanity in Muslims.
It didn't occur to me how much I had shared until a couple weeks before the book came out back in May. My boss at the Shalom Hartman Institute walked in with a copy of the book. She'd received an advanced copy, which incidentally I had ordered for her. And then it occurred to me that she was now going to read every single intimate detail of my life because I had written it. And at that one, I was like a little bit like maybe I went a little bit too far with that one. But now there's no going back. So I guess.
Talk about the work you do in the Shalom Hartman Institute. This is essentially to create better relations between Muslims and Jews.
Right? Yeah. So I got involved with the Hartman Institute 4 years ago when a small group of American Muslim leaders were invited to the Hartman Institute's headquarters in Jerusalem, which is in the news again, to study Israel, Judaism, and Zionism with Israeli academics and scholars and thinkers. And I ended up so moved by the experience and intrigued by the possibilities that I now work for the Hartman Institute. And I actually teach courses on Islam to Jewish audiences. I build Muslim-Jewish engagement. I help find Muslim leaders who I think are good partners in this kind of endeavor. It's really interesting work. And I think in this moment, especially for us as Americans, learning how to talk like across difference without forcing people into agreement or permanent disagreement is one of the most important things we could do.
Well, you may have been raised a religious Muslim, but you have a lot of characteristics in your background which suggest Jewish upbringing. Your parents wanted you to only be a doctor or a lawyer, right?
That is a very Pakistani-American story. I think Pakistanis and Jews might be the same people. We were just separated several thousand years ago.
Well, actually, they say that about Palestinians and Jews more so, that they are the same people.
That definitely. But on the medicine front, I don't know where that comes from, but both our communities seem obsessed with medical careers.
Did you see the movie that was made about the Pakistani young man and the American woman made by Judd Apatow?
I feel like the worst Pakistani-American in the world because I haven't seen the movie. And everyone asks me if I've seen the movie, and I have not. So I apologize. I can pretend like I've seen it, and then
no,
we can
don't
have a
pretend.
Conversation.
It's okay. Next time we have a conversation, maybe you'll have seen it. But it's certainly a movie that gets into a lot of issues about being Pakistani in America. And there's a big difference between, let's say, Pakistani identity here in the United States. It's called the Big Sick, by the way. The Pakistani identity here and Pakistani identity in the U.K., because in the U.K. there have been much more terrorist acts that have been linked to Pakistanis or those of Pakistani origin.
Well, the dynamic in the United States is so interesting because a lot of the Pakistani Americans and a lot of Muslim Americans date back to the 1960s. So as part of the civil rights movement, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, we lifted restrictions on immigration quotas and a lot of professionals came. So there were people who were very well educated who came at a time in America when their careers would be very well remunerated. And as a result, the American Muslim community, although small, is very well to do. Of course, not equally and across the board, but there's a lot of wealth and a lot of professional achievement in the Muslim community. And so you have people who've done pretty well for themselves. And I think after 9/11, it was this moment of whiplash. Like, what just happened? How is it that we found ourselves suddenly under this microscope when we had nothing to do with these things and we never even conceived of ourselves in opposition to American or Western society?
Well, you shouldn't obviously have to be the spokesperson for Muslims throughout the world, particularly since they're very different in, say, Pakistan than they are in India or Myanmar or, you know, wherever you want to look. But when your book is also, like I say, a coming-of-age book, and it's a book of about 30-somethings, it has a lot of identities, the Pakistani-American identity. And I'm just wondering about the second generation, because there are many of those Muslims who were brought up as citizens in the United States and I'm thinking about Pakistani origin Muslims in the UK who are second generation and who become quite radicalized.
I don't particularly see it as a widespread by any means problem in the American Muslim context. I mean, the number of people who have been radicalized is vanishingly small. Actually, in the United States, you're more likely to be killed because someone thinks you're a Muslim than to be killed by a Muslim. So anti-Muslim extremism is a bigger threat in America than Muslim extremism, which I think
I certainly didn't mean to imply anything.
Oh, of course, of course.
Opposed to that, but I'm thinking about, like, Dearborn, you know, has a very high Muslim population, and some of the younger people, according to some studies, have been younger people who were born here, who are American citizens, who are drawn to jihadi thing.
Yeah, I mean, that exists. It's a really interesting conversation to be part of. I did work in national security for a while, and one of the most troubling and odd statistics was that if you look at ISIS recruitment back when ISIS was kind of a more potent movement with territory, not where they are now, about 40% of ISIS recruits in the United States weren't even Muslim. They weren't born Muslim. They weren't even converts to Islam. They converted to Islam through ISIS propaganda. And so, again, these things happen, but I think they're extremely rare. And I think for most American Muslims, the conversations we're having are pretty much not that dissimilar from any other minority in the United States. So we have the same, obviously, concerns as Americans. And then on top of it, this feeling of, as you said earlier, what future do we have in this country when bashing us actually earns you political capital, at least in one of the two political parties?
Again, we're talking, if you've just joined us, with Haroon Mogul, who's here with us in studio, who's the author of a new book called How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. And the book starts out with you suicidal.
That was hard. That was really hard to write. And I thought for a long time about whether or not I wanted to share that part of me. And of course, one of the reasons I did is because I feel like too many people struggle with that and think they're alone in that, especially in Muslim communities and Pakistani American communities. There are these very heavy taboos around mental illness. And it has been gratifying to me being on the book tour and coming across folks, especially young folks who should have everything in the world to look forward to, who come to me and say they're struggling with the same feelings and they have no one to talk to. But one of the reasons I wrote it is also because I was struggling when I wrote this book to make sense of my life and trying to come to terms with what it means to be bipolar and to understand that this is something that I'll probably have to deal with for the rest of my life was not easy. And writing and thinking it out was a way for me to come to terms with it and learn how to deal with it.
A lot of the book has to do with the bipolar diagnosis and the suffering from bipolar, but also has to do with what could, I suppose, be carried. I mean, you had a fairly well-to-do background. Your parents are both physicians, I believe.
That was true, yeah.
And yet it was a tough youth in many ways. I mean, but a tough youth that many can identify with. Acne, strong sexual drives that couldn't necessarily be put into a context of freedom. Forbidden to go to a prom, all of those kinds of things. I just wonder, you know, to what extent you were also shaped by just what you were prohibited from doing as opposed to what you felt you could do.
I think fundamentally for me, the great divide was between my parents' world and their expectations of me and then everyone around me. I grew up in a farm town in New England. It was a very nice town. I don't think I ever want to live in a farm town again, but everyone was very friendly and very nice. I never encountered any kind of overt hostility.
You were the only Muslim, though.
I was the only Muslim.
And the only dark fellow.
I was the only Haroon. Actually, when the first Godzilla movie came out in the 90s, for those of the listeners who were unfortunate enough to have seen the movie, there was a scene in which one of the cab drivers was revealed to have the name Haroon. And one of my friends, James, who'd known me at this point for 10 years, turned to me in the movie theater and said, with genuine surprise, "You do have a real name." And he had probably, basically, he had assumed this whole time that my parents, just for reasons of wicked cruelty, had decided to make up a name and just assign it to me.
See, forgive me, that's a funny story. And you do have humor in here. I want to get that into the mix, too, because, like I say, it begins with a suicide and bipolar and all these heavy-duty things, but there's some good humor. Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it helps you cope with the dark stuff. And there's not enough humor in Muslim spaces and Muslim communities. Most of our sermons tend to be an imam who's really angry at everyone and probably himself as well. And so I like to keep things a little bit lighthearted because there's not enough of that.
Well, one of the things that helped change you was meeting another imam in Dubai, right? I mean, that was a turning point for you.
And the last thing I expected in the world was to go to someone who looked like that, who by all means and all of my prior experience was going to be this very conservative, kind of religiously right-wing, very harsh, insular, parochial imam. And I went to him because I was at the end of my rope and I had no idea what to do with myself religiously, personally, any way, shape, or form. And I go to him for advice. And the advice he gave me was so surprising that I remember just driving home completely dumbfounded. Because rather than tell me what I was doing wrong, he told me, and I'll never forget this, that I had to love myself. And I had never, I mean, there is a long Muslim tradition of love and compassion and things like that. But in the religious discourse I had been raised in, you never use that word, and certainly never about yourself. The idea of loving yourself seemed like some sort of egoistic exercise. And here for this guy with this, you know, super long beard and amazingly large turban, to tell me that I'm supposed to love myself was the last thing I thought I would hear.
Because you were hating yourself.
I hated myself, yeah. Which is amazing. I it was kind of, looking back on it, I mean, I had such negative self-image. It's actually astonishing that I beat myself up all the time.
And a lot of that had to do with not being able to follow the creed as it was taught to you, as it was fed to you, right?
I have nephews now, and sometimes I read them storybooks about Islam and things like that. And I remember coming across a chapter about heaven and hell. And I remember thinking to myself, do I really want to read a book about heaven and hell to a five-year-old? That's kind of an awkward conversation to have about, you know, why are people on fire? And yet that was what we were raised with. And it was this idea that if you came up short in any way, shape, or form, you'd just be lit on fire for the rest of your life. And when you're 10 or 12 years old and you're convinced you're going to hell, probably not a very healthy place to be.
So you also had a struggle with atheism, didn't you?
I did. And I know you've written about this, so probably a lot there to talk about. But I did have a spell where I was at least tactically an atheist because I wanted to go to prom and I wanted to get drunk. And I couldn't do that as a Muslim. So I was like, hey, if I just strategically pretend like God is not looking / listening, then everything will work out just fine. But it didn't work out that way.
No, but, you know, you take us through your whole metamorphosis, and a lot of it not only has to do with a split identity between being Pakistani and American or being Muslim and American, but also it's a split identity between the political and the spiritual, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the most interesting things about this moment right now to be an American Muslim is that for the first time on a collective scale, our religious identity is being turned into an ethnic identity. Because when Donald Trump said that we should ban Muslim immigration to the United States, or when a Ben Carson says a Muslim is not fit for the office of the president or vice president, or Roy Moore says that Muslims shouldn't serve in Congress, they're not saying certain types of Muslims, they're not saying religiously Muslim, they're not saying, you know, fundamentalist Muslim, they're just saying Muslim across the board. So does that mean that if you're someone of Muslim heritage but you're an atheist, you're non-practicing, that you're included in that category? And so suddenly this very tiny community, we find ourselves in this room and the walls are closing in around us, and yet we have so little in common, and we have to figure out now in this moment, what does it mean to be a Muslim in America when the rest of the world seems to be judging us in this collective language?
And you seem to indicate that perhaps the collective judgment should not be veered toward, as many people on the right suggested it was, toward this is a religion of peace and you can't, you know, indict people who are Muslims, because obviously among any people, among any faith, there are going to be people who are radical and extreme. And the reality is to not say, for example, and this was a lot of language debates, you can't say certain words about Muslims being revolutionary, Muslims being terrorists. You can't put those things together and shouldn't put those things together because it cloaks too many.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, personally, I understand why some Muslims will say things like Islam is a religion of peace. To me, it's no different than, you know, when President Obama would respond to a hate crime and say, that's not America. Now, obviously, we know that that is part of America, and it's unfortunately a significant part of America, but he was speaking aspirationally. I do, however, have a problem when Muslims say things like Islam is a religion of peace in order to deny that the religion is used by some people to encourage and pursue horrific violence. And for us as a community, and if we care about our community and care about the future of our community, we have to reckon with the way in which religion is used to circumscribe people, to harm people, to oppress people, to even kill people.
Again, we're talking to Harun Mogul. He's here with us in studio. He's a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute, talking about his memoir, How to Be a Muslim, An American Story. He'll be appearing at the JCC in Palo Alto tonight at 8 p.m., and you can join us, and I invite you to do that now. If you'd like to join the conversation, particularly like to hear from some American Muslims, but if you have questions or comments for our guests, please feel free to bring them to the fore. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number. Please feel free to do that. Again, it's 866-733-6786 for your phone calls. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Number of ways of joining the program and being part of the conversation. You can, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or you can go to our Facebook page. But please feel free to be part of the program. Here's Ben, who writes, as we head into the holiday season, are there holidays that Muslims celebrate during this time of year? He wants to know.
The biggest, most significant Muslim holiday of this time of year is Thanksgiving. It's when we gather because Allah brought us to this country to eat turkey. Actually, I think Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday because...
if you think of Muslim holidays, you usually think of Ramadan.
Yeah, I mean, it's the paradox. Ramadan is you don't eat, and Thanksgiving is all you do is eat. But I think Thanksgiving is the greatest holiday in history because you can literally just sit there and take a nap, and no one thinks it's weird. But the big Muslim holidays, there's really two very big holidays. One is at the end of Ramadan, a month of fasting. We celebrate by going to the mosque and eating stale donuts because apparently that's what the Prophet Muhammad wanted us to do. There's always someone who goes to Dunkin' Donuts and buys 500 donuts and leaves them in the basement. That's what we do. That's actually what the American Muslim Eid experience is like.
And the police officers, they're eating stale donuts too.
We actually do that for the police officers who are basically surveilling the mosque. We want them to feel at home and not feel like we're hiding anything. And so that's one holiday. And then the second big one is about 70 days later, coinciding with the pilgrimage to Mecca. Which is an honor of when Abraham was asked to sacrifice his son and was willing to sacrifice his son and was stopped at the very last moment by an angel. And so that's the biggest holiday of the Muslim year. And then there are all kinds of – I mean, the Prophet Muhammad's birthday was just a few days ago. And there was actually a bunch of celebrations here in the Bay Area. And you see that all across the Muslim world.
Are you bothered, for example, when, you know, there's sometimes strong feelings about anything that should be said negative about Muhammad, peace be unto him, and all of that. Does this bother you?
Honestly, it doesn't bother me that much. Obviously, on a personal level, sure, when someone mocks or insults your religion or those things that you hold to be sacred or important to you, those things are hurtful. But I am a very big believer in having a robust public conversation. And so I understand that, obviously, for me to have the freedom to practice my religion depends on the freedom to also criticize my religion.
And you still are a practicing Muslim?
I think the word practicing is very loaded. I would say that I'm a Muslim who's trying very hard to live up to the religion. I find a lot of the terms that we use in the Muslim community to be a little bit presumptuous. So I feel like if I say I'm a practicing Muslim, it's like I'm saying I'm this wonderful human being, and I don't know if I would go quite that far.
What are some of those things that you find?
So for me, you know, I joined recently, for lack of a better term, kind of like a Sufi order, a spiritual circle, and there's a lot of prayer and ritual that's affiliated with that. But it's a very private and personal thing to me. And I do talk about Islam a lot. I do the professional Muslim thing. But I feel like it's really spiritually toxic when you make religion your public identity and you start preaching to people about religiosity, because there's a lot of temptation to power, and that causes a lot of damage to a person.
So when you called yourself a professional Muslim, it meant more identity, perhaps, than it did religion.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Again, please feel free to join the program. We're talking with Harun Mogul, and you can join us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Harun Mogul. He's a fellow in Jewish-Muslim relations at the Shalom Hartman Institute, and he's also the author of a memoir called How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. And you can join us on the program. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. And I'm going to go right to our calls and emails here in just a moment. But I want to get to the heart of your memoir, which I think, like I said, it begins with you thinking very seriously about suicide, and a lot of it had to do with the demons you were grappling with. But what makes this a universal story for me as a reader is you felt like a failure, and you felt like a failure not only personally in your life, and you pretty much sketched this out for us in detail, but for the life after that you talked about, you know, reading hell stories to young children and everything, because they were vivid in your mind.
I hear a lot of times people say that religion is a crutch. And so religion is a way to distinguish your group, which is the good group, from the out group or the bad group. And yet, paradoxically, Islam looks at it backwards. So in Islam, the more you know about God and religion, the more likely you are to go to hell. Because God will not judge a people who have never encountered revelation, right? And God judges most harshly or most severely those people who have the most knowledge. It's a little bit like Spider-Man: with great power comes great responsibility, or the other way around.
There's a conflation, Spider-Man and Islam.
Spider-Man and Islam.
But are there Islamic scholars who would disagree with you, or Islamic imams and so forth?
I think there definitely are, but from what I've seen, it was very much the case of you know, now you know this, you have to act on it. And so I was raised in a very religiously literate household, which meant that I not only knew about the things that I was supposed to do, but I knew that if I didn't do them, I was in trouble. And so probably feeling like you're a spiritual failure is among the worst types of failure you could imagine, because it kind of implies that the rest of eternity will be one of damnation and perdition.
But you could see a religious Calvinist-oriented evangelical feeling the same way, couldn't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
or an Orthodox Jew, or, you know, you go down the line.
I think it's a very common religious experience, but when you grow up and you're that age, you probably feel like you're entirely alone in this. Because when everyone around you is upholding certain public norms, you start feeling like you're the only person who has these thoughts, or you're the only person who has these doubts. And so you must be uniquely perverse. And you must be somehow special. And so God really hates you, because everyone else has got it working out for them except for you. And so there was this feeling that not only was I damned, but that God wanted me to be damned, because there was just something about me that was defective. And you mentioned this earlier. It's amazing to think about now. I thought sexual desire made me abnormal, because I didn't think that people had sexual desire, or at least Muslims didn't have sexual desire, and it wasn't normal. And so when I was 14 or 15 and started noticing girls around me and feeling attracted to them, I thought I was the worst human being on the planet, because I had no language to make sense of this most basic human impulse. And to go through your life thinking that the most elemental parts of your nature are evidence of God's hatred for you is not a very good way to go through your life.
Led to panic attacks, in fact.
Absolutely.
Which you write about as well. Here's Jake, who wants to know, how can we encourage greater religious tolerance in the Middle East? The American colonies had 150 years of despotically enforced religious tolerance, which led to a generation that was open to religious freedom. How can we do the same for the Middle East? Now, again, there's this assumption that you have the answers to this, because you are a spokesperson, a professional Muslim, as you describe yourself. But thoughts as you, Harun Mogul, think.
I do think that what we're seeing in the Middle East right now is actually not very different from the European wars of religion. And so we forget that after the Reformation, that there were these really violent conflicts around religious identity and politics. And what I've seen in traveling through the Middle East is at times inspiring and at times deeply disturbing, even just from a religious point of view. I think there's a lot of people, a lot of young folks, who have entirely lost their faith, because they're so disgusted by the political uses of religion around them, and not just extremist groups, but authoritarian governments, that they see religion as only a source of harm or hindrance. And what seems to be happening in fits and starts is the politicization of religion, which inevitably ends with the secularization of society.
Let me bring in our callers, and we'll go first to a caller from Palo Alto. Mahmoud, good morning.
Hey, Michael, thank you very much. Excellent program as always. And Harun, assalamu alaikum. This is Mashood, a Pakistani Muslim American as well. I can relate to a lot of what you have been talking about. I'm raising a family over here. I migrated myself 20 years back, and I have teenage kids. And I can see a lot of the conflicts that you had gone through in their mind too. So my comment is about, and question perhaps, is what have your experience been in terms of the inner conflict within Pakistani-American community, that they mingle the cultural aspect with the religious aspect, and some of those cultural aspects actually go totally against the teachings of Islam. For example, Islam talks about pondering over Quran, and here the focus is on recitation without understanding a word of Arabic. So would love to hear your thoughts about this experience.
Well, first of all, welcome, Salam. Thank you so much for calling in. I had a unique childhood, because my parents were not particularly cultural. They were actually very religiously literate. So we got a lot of education as opposed to indoctrination, which somehow is at times harder to deal with. I do think that some of this is just the process of growing older. But I do think that one of the ways out of this is actually to expose people of faith to other faith traditions. So if, for example, you're talking about a Pakistani-American family that's concerned with too much culture seeping into religious life, sometimes it's really helpful to experience different types of Islam. So it's good for yourself personally, and then it's good for the health of your community to know that different parts of the world practice the religion differently, and to then have sustained conversations about why that is and what that means and whether those are good things or bad things, and how to bring about the same kind of culture in America, as in an American Muslim culture for us and by us.
And let me thank Masood for the call and go to more of your calls. Let's go next to caller Matthew. You're on.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me on. So my question is about how to deal with people who use Islamophobia as a shield for critique. Here in California, there are two examples I would call your attention to. The first is Imam Shaheen in Davis, who openly called for the genocide of Jews. And the second is Dr. Hatem Basian, who is a lecturer at Berkeley. Both of them still retain their positions. Dr. Hatem Basian was tweeting terrible anti-Semitic tweets and depictions of Jews with giant rat noses. And it's just, I mean, there's no reason for these people to have jobs, but they claim that any critique that comes against them is Islamophobia.
It's an important question, Matthew. Let me go to hear what Harun Mogul has to say.
So thank you for the question. I believe I know the story of the imam in question. I'm not particularly specific on it, so I don't want to go there and say something that's not based in fact. With Dr. Basian, who's a lecturer at Berkeley, I know exactly the tweets you refer to, and they were profoundly offensive. There were two images in particular, from what I recall, that were tweeted out. One of them,
I know him for many years, by the way, and I was kind of shocked at.
It's a little bit odd. But again, I don't know much of the backstory, so I don't want to comment on specific individuals. One thing I will say, and I've seen this across the board now, is that there's a lot of intolerance in the United States generally around a lot of public conversations. I've seen on university campuses that a lot of conversations are getting shut down for fear of causing offense to people. And what we need to figure out as a society is acknowledging the real hurt and pain and consequences of racism and discrimination, while also preserving the ability to have robust public conversations.
And it's the same kind of thing with Islamophobia as it is with antisemitism or racism. If you use those words too loosely, you're taking away from the reality of when they can be indeed what they are.
Of the far more perverse consequences. And to me, ultimately, what counts as Islamophobia is when you're making a generalization that causes harm to people. And so simply critiquing my faith or my perspective on the world doesn't cause me harm in a political sense. It actually, I think, preserves my identity as a Muslim in many respects. And how we get there, I think, is not just a conversation about Islamophobia. It's exactly as you said. It's a conversation about American society right now, where we seem to be divided between thinking everything is designed to shut down conversation, and then thinking the exact same thing on the opposite side. And so we've lost the ability to talk to each other reasonably.
You know, there was an article. Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. There's an article in Haaretz, which is a somewhat left-leaning Israeli newspaper I'm sure you're familiar with, about you and your book, and they talked about your book being really coming across with the vitality of multiculturalism, was I think the phrase that was used, that you still have a vitality of multiculturalism that you can see in your book, which goes all against the worst kind of assumptions of the Trumpism that we're identifying here. I mean, would you feel that you're indeed contributing to a more higher ideal of multiculturalism?
I think so. I think that right now in this moment, we tend to get really down on ourselves, given President Trump and some of the folks who surround him and what they represent and what they stand for. But we also discount the fact that this is an incredibly resilient country with some fascinating people and movements and ideologies and amazing leaders, from established leaders to people who are coming up, and even in American Muslim communities. And this is something I wish more people saw, including American Muslims, who tend to get very down on themselves. We have a really dynamic and thriving community. It's a young community, institutionally speaking, so we're not where we should be or could be, and that's a generational project. But just on the book tour and traveling around the United States and Canada, I've met so many remarkable young Muslims of all different levels of religiosity who are doing amazing things, whether within their own communities or within their context more generally, people active in politics, people who are artists or lawyers or journalists. And that's the image that I wanted to get across a little bit of, that we're complicated people. And it actually goes back to the first caller's question about cultural Islam versus religious Islam. And I think I reached a point in my life where I decided that instead of seeing all these identities as oppositional, I actually see them as contributing towards a richer sense of self. So I am American. I am of Pakistani heritage. I work on Muslim Jewish stuff. I'm interested in this thing. I'm interested in that thing. And I don't need to see these things as oppositional. And the problem with the Trump moment and that kind of ideology is that it's always or. It's never and. So you're either American or Muslim. You're either American or this. And I think the most important thing we can do in this moment is reject that kind of thinking.
Being American in many people's minds means diversity, multiculturalism. But many other people's minds, it means, you know, you keep on your side of the street, we'll keep on our side of the street. What do you say to that argument? I mean, because it's an argument that sometimes is put forward, you know, with what necessarily aren't bad intentions, just maybe a realistic or pragmatic view.
Well, the question I would ask is whether people are actually being kept to their side of the street out of their own free will, or they're being forced onto different sides of the street. And so, unfortunately, the history of racism and discrimination in this country suggests that many times it's not a voluntary choice. It's that people are being denied entry into certain neighborhoods. Donald Trump's father, for example, was recognized, shall we say, for this kind of discrimination.
Against black people, specifically.
Exactly, yeah, and refusing to rent or to make units available in his properties to African Americans. And so I don't begrudge the sentiment. I just want to make sure that the sentiment comes out of people's volition and not out of an active desire to marginalize people.
Well, you've said, as a, quote, professional Muslim, as you called yourself, especially during that period when you were, after 9/11, asked to speak out, that too often you were asked to explain or apologize. But here's Stephen, who says, what is your guest's attitude toward the parts, and I'm sure you were asked this many times, of the Quran that sanction violence against non-believers?
So the interesting thing that most people seem to not realize about Islam is that nobody ever read the Quran in isolation. And, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't difficult texts in the Quran or the Islamic tradition. But I see that as something that, you know, we constantly have to come to terms with and understand as a community and find interpretations of that matter in our moment. And that's no different than, I think, where we are as a country in the United States, where we've seen a resurrection of white supremacist ideology. The minute you think that you've driven something to the corners and it's never coming back, it will come back. And so every religion has temptations and ideologies that will produce violence. And in Islam, we obviously see these. And so the task of every responsible community is to find ways to come to terms with that history that is relevant to and appropriate to the modern context. And that's a generational project, as in every generation of Muslims has to do that. And the minute you let that project go, people far worse than yourselves will fill the gap and promote ideas and ideologies that are deeply dangerous.
Well, here's a caller who's on point, I believe. Dar, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. Thank you, Michael. Again, now, I was wondering your guest's opinion on the fact that the Islam is the only religion that the founder, Muhammad himself, had committed war crimes. This is in Medina when he massacred the men of the Ibn Quraiza in Medina. And I hate to, you know, see all these interpretations and these young people that still hang on to some philosophical and Sufi that ideology that still wants to keep this religion as is and sort of the reason away the fact that there are a lot of violence that the founder himself did, and this is unlike any other religion. You cannot compare it to Jesus, Moses, and Buddha, Zardosht, the Persian Zardosht. And I really want these young people to pay attention to the facts, not just the philosophical or semantics that all religions have these, especially, you know, like Judaism has some related violence to their text. But the thing is, you have to...
Dar, you're saying this is distinctive. I understand the import of your question. Let me get Harun to respond.
Well, the first thing I would say is I guess no one's read the Old Testament, which is kind of interesting, which features as much violence and you know, presents it as religious truth and religious model. This is reality in every religious tradition. I frankly find the contention otherwise to be kind of ridiculous. I mean, one can say, for example, that Jesus never engaged in this kind of violence, which is true. And yet the history of Christianity also includes a history of tremendous violence often in the name of religious leaders and formative religious figures.
Jesus did say, I've come to put the son against the father, the daughter against the mother, and so forth. And so, militant Jesus.
I think the reality is that human beings are always tempted to violence. And there are people who profit off of that and people who promote that. And it is the task of every community, as I said, to find ways to confront those ideologies and find ways for us as diverse communities to live together productively.
What about when you're, and let me thank Dr. Nicole, when you're asked, we have now, for example, the spectacle of Judge Moore, who's a man who's been charged with molestation of young women when he was younger and essentially pedophilia. And there are those who have essentially been very critical of Muhammad for being with women who are underage.
Well, the irony of this moment is that many of the things that I'm always accused of as a Muslim by people generally on the far right, but sometimes on the far left, are things that right now, at least the Republican Party seems uniquely comfortable with. I do think that the way a lot of these things have been framed about Islam are deeply problematic. I mean, this includes Muslims, right? To simply say that Muhammad did something in the 7th century and therefore the exact same thing applies now is a really dangerous thing to do when Muslims do it as well.
Jefferson was a slave owner in a way, isn't it? I mean, you have to see things in the context of the time.
And not even just that. I mean, so the Prophet Muhammad had a marriage arranged with someone who is much younger, right? Didn't mean they were married. It just means their marriage was arranged. Now, my parents had their marriage arranged, right? That's literally one generation ago. It's not something I could ever do. And I don't think it's anything most American Muslims could do or most Americans could do. And yet several generations ago, arranged marriages were common across the world. And it didn't imply that, okay, the person is literally marrying someone who's a child. It just meant that when you were very young, someone had decided who you were going to marry. So that's, I think, and this gets to the previous call as well, and that's the work that has to be done, is to say, okay, these are the social conditions of the time. These are social conditions of now. How do we take this religion and the principles and the values and apply them to our context in a way that makes sense to our context? And it's exactly like you said. I mean, people change and perspectives change, and that work, that messy work, is where the really interesting stuff happens.
That's an interesting comment by a listener, Marte. Get your response and have you reflect on this. She says, can you explain that both Islam and Judaism and by extension Christianity are worshiping the same Abrahamic God?
Sometimes I feel like, since we're talking about Spider-Man, that the Abrahamic religions are like Spider-Man. They keep getting remade. And so they're like they're remixes of the same religion. And I work in a Jewish institution, and I'm constantly surprised by how similar Islam and Judaism are, not just in terms of our lived experience, but how our religions function. And it seems to me that maybe one of the reasons why we fight so much is because we have so much to disagree over. If we didn't have much in common, then we wouldn't really have much to argue about.
Look at what's been going on in Islam for centuries between Sunni and Shia. But I'm also interested in finding out your thoughts, because you mentioned before that someone was asking you about Hamas and what do you think of Hamas and so forth, as if somebody of Pakistani descent and who just as Islamic background has some connection there. But here you are working for a Jewish organization, and you must be asked a lot, because now it's very much in the news, about the move of the capital to Jerusalem.
Well, my own politics on this, I think, stand pretty far apart from the institution I work for. So I'll say that as a disclaimer. And this is just my analysis. I mean, I cannot speak on behalf of Palestinians. Obviously, I don't live there. I'm not Palestinian. I don't obviously speak on behalf of Israelis. But as someone, as an American and as a Muslim who is concerned by what's happening in the region, who's attached to Jerusalem religiously, I think the only solution ultimately is some kind of one-state solution, a confederation between the two peoples. And to me, the talk of moving the capital to Jerusalem only underscores that the two-state solution died a long time ago. And while I think, I don't begrudge anyone who promotes it as a solution, and I don't think it's there's any negative intention behind promoting it by any means. I just think that window has closed. And so for me, I think it's disheartening.
Why do you think the window has closed?
I mean, the construction of settlements, the fact that there can be no contiguous Palestinian state at this point, the fact that the Palestinian Authority itself seems remarkably sclerotic and incapable of governance on any level. I don't see how you divide a territory that small into two fully sovereign states. I don't think it's possible. Even the most generous two-state proposals still advocated for a demilitarized Palestinian state whose borders would be controlled by Israel. So even the two-state solutions that were on offer were fundamentally some kind of confederation where the two peoples would have obligations and responsibilities towards each other that sovereign states normally don't have. And I mean, traveling to Jerusalem, I simply have no idea how you take a city like Jerusalem and split it in half.
Well, this is mainly Trump's present Israeli ambassador. It certainly was not the part of previous administrations, and I don't know that it's going to be brought forward. But I'm also wondering, you know, there's another similarity between, say, Jews and Muslims. You grow up with this notion, this is good for Muslims or bad for Muslims. This is good for the Jews or bad for the Jews, particularly when things happen in the news that have to do with your people or your tribe or your identity. Just wondering, did you have a response when Danny Pearl was beheaded in Pakistan by Pakistanis, Pakistani Muslims?
I think I had a response as a journalist. I found it
but not
horrifying.
Necessarily as a Muslim or Pakistani background.
No, I think both. I think obviously as a journalist, there was a sense of fear of what happens to people who try to tell the truth or to try to investigate stories. But look, it's a very fine distinction I'm trying to make. I don't think it's fair to hold a community in one place responsible for a community in another place. And frankly, we do believe in individual rights, so we can't even hold an individual responsibility for their own community. But there's no way you're not affected by it personally. Right? I mean, when the Arab Spring happened and I saw those young Egyptians and Tunisians come out into the streets, I was proud to be Muslim in this way that was very elemental, right? Like this is something good is happening in this part of the world that I'm associated with and that I have a connection to. And when it went south, I felt it personally. And there's no way you can't. If you identify with a religion, you're going to feel the ups and downs. And for me, as someone, again, I was born here. I did not live in Pakistan for any part of my life other than a few months here and there. So I can't speak as a Pakistani, obviously. It's not my country. But obviously, it's where my family came from. And so when I see what's happening there and I see the bad news, it hurts on a really...
You internalize it.
Yeah, because it's like, this is where my family came from. And had my parents made a couple different decisions, that's where I would have lived. And that would have been my identity. And to this point of extremism, my grandfather used to worship in a mosque, and I used to remember going with him in the 80s when I was a kid, when he was still alive. And the mosque was later taken over by an extremist group and had to be attacked by the military to root them out. And how do you not get affected by that?
Let me get another caller on with us. Misty, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm married to a Pakistani Muslim. I converted to Islam. I was Muslim for a while. And as a feminist and raising a daughter, the religion just didn't make any sense to me anymore. I'm Unitarian now. But, you know, it's just not logical when I can see I have a son and a daughter. My daughter is actually a much better student, much brighter than my son in a lot of areas. I mean, he's a hard worker. And even my husband can admit I'm more academic. I'm more intelligent in some areas than he is. It just didn't make sense to me that men should be in charge, whether it's Christianity, Islam, or anything. And my daughter now, who's 14, does not want to have anything to do with the religion, neither does my son. So I'm just wondering, when is that going to really be addressed? There's no reason anymore in the world that men should be in charge of families.
Well, you raise an important question. Male hegemony, male supremacy, I mentioned all religions, but the argument is it's very much a part of the fabric of Islam particularly.
I mean, look at America right now. You mentioned Roy Moore. We've got a guy who holds himself up as a paragon of family values who, you know, is being accused of being a pedophile, and we've got a president who's on camera admitting to sexual assault. So this is a problem across the board, not just for Muslims. But that doesn't excuse it, and I think Misty is right. I think Muslim men have not done a particularly good job of running very much, and so definitely there should be some transition. Look, the problem in much of the Muslim world is not just that men are running things, it's that the same men are running things over and over and over again, that there's not even a turnover in terms of the sort of elite class. But this is something I work towards, and what I would say is that the only way it's going to change is if people stick around and fight back. And the easy thing to do when faced with a mosque that's misogynistic or an interpretation of religion or a culture that's misogynistic is to walk away. And I don't begrudge anyone who does that at all. But those of us who care about what happens down the road can't allow ourselves to walk away and be pushed out by people who, frankly, are causing so much harm.
Let me thank the caller, Misty, and go to another comment from David, who says, as a fair and open-minded person, I find Islam hard to defend, given that millions of people suffer under justice systems that lack basic human rights and use Islam as justification. Can your guest please respond?
I would say the same thing about being American sometimes. Our country has armed for many years many of these same regimes. And if our moral standard
still
is
does.
That, and we still do, yeah. I mean, the Saudis are bombing and blockading, the Saudi government is bombing and blockading Yemen and causing a humanitarian crisis, and those are our weapons. The Egyptian government is jailing and torturing tens of thousands of people, and we're helping them do it. And so the interesting thing about the comment, and I'll just say this, is that many people in the Muslim world say the exact same thing about America. And that's the reality of where we've gotten to, and that's what we need to get out of.
We've got seconds left here, but I want to get at your response to Mark, who writes, if your guest is concerned by representing an entire religion, perhaps he should speak only for himself and not claim to know what a Muslim should or should not be.
I never said I did speak on behalf of anyone else. And the title of the book is very tongue-in-cheek, which is why everyone should read it, because it's very much the story of what it means to struggle with a religion personally when people think that you represent it collectively.
And the title again is How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. Thank you, Haroon. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Haroon Mogul, and he'll be at the JCC this evening, 8 o'clock, down at Palo Alto. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow, in this hour, we're going to be talking about sleep and dreams, and we're going to get the latest research on sleep and insomnia and sleeping pills and all the rest of that. Thank you for being a part of this program this morning. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.